and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and joining us this week is Hackensack Meridian Health's Dr. Ahmed Siddiqui, orthopedic surgeon. Dr. Siddiqui, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Joel.
Yes,
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. Now, listen, orthopedics is what we're going to focus on today. It covers a wide range of specialties, you know, hand, shoulder, elbow, spine, foot, ankle. That's not even all of them. Yours is hip and knee. So what led you to hip and knee? And, you know, when did you know that this is what you wanted to do?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I spent a lot of my early time in medical school spending time with one of my mentors up in North Jersey who sub-specialized in hip and knee replacements. And just spending some time with him kind of, you know, led me to my strong interest in orthopedics, not only, but specifically hip and knee replacement. And as I, you know, started my training in residency and I got exposed to all the subspecialties, you know, within orthopedics, like you were mentioning, you know, hip and knee is what, you know, always drew me a lot closer, you know, from the surgical side as well as managing patients afterwards. It was just such a gratifying subspecialty within orthopedics. And I was lucky to be able to pursue that, you know, in my subspecialty training and pretty much doing what I've dreamt about doing from an early time.
How early?
How early? So I knew I wanted to do orthopedics since I was in high school. And then as I went to college, you know, that really, really, you know, just exposure to, you know, injuries, sports, you know, orthopedics in general, you know, I kind of knew orthopedics was it early on. And then as I got into, you know, my first year of medical school, I knew I wanted to do joint replacements pretty early on.
And there's, you know, there's a variety within the hip and knee joint, the replacement. You've got partial knee, revision knee, knee replacement. What are the differences between those three, partial, revision, and replacement?
Yeah,
or are
that's
they
a
similar?
Great question. So replacement, so there's, you know, first-time replacements, which we call primary hip or knee replacements, and anytime you have surgery to redo that for a variety of other reasons, whether, you know, whether there's a complication or failure or, you know, just in terms of, you know, the parts kind of wear out over time, that requires a redo operation is what we call revision. You know, from the partial specifically, from the knee side, you know, full knee replacement where you're kind of resurfacing the entire knee versus a partial where you're resurfacing just the inside or outside or underneath the kneecap specifically. So it's pretty much, you know, patient specific in terms of what their, you know, pattern of arthritis is and what their activity level is and, you know, a lot of other different factors that we look at before we decide to proceed one procedure over the other. But that's the basic difference between first time and primary hip and knee replacement versus the redo or the revisions.
See, now I always thought that there was a difference. If you needed surgery, it wasn't arthritic. Like arthritic was something that you couldn't do anything about. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so there's different kinds of surgical procedures. So oftentimes patients get confused about a cleanup procedure or a small arthroscopic or scope procedure where you kind of come in with a camera, you shave away the ends of the arthritis, and it's all good. But, you know, all the research has shown that type of procedure for arthritis doesn't really do as well. But the only thing that's curative of the arthritis in the knees and the hips is a replacement type of procedure. Shy of that, there's no real other surgical procedure out there that is that's a definitive cure for arthritis.
So the replacement is the cure for arthritis, but it's the only cure.
Correct.
You can't. I see. Okay. So what's involved in, let's say, replacing a hip?
Yeah. So
without getting too for in layman's terms.
Yeah, of course. So what it involves is you get access to the hip joint itself. There's a lot of different ways to go about that. There's, you know, the front approach, the side approach, the back approach, the top approach. There's a slew of different, you know, approaches you can do to get access to the hip joint itself. All the research shows that all the approaches do the same in terms of outcomes-wise. So whatever your, you know, surgeon's the most comfortable with in terms of their training and their subspecialty training is what they should, you know, I tell patients is, you know, that's what, you know, they should do and they should go to a surgeon that feels comfortable doing that approach. So once you're inside the hip joint itself, you basically, you know, the hip is a ball and socket joint. We basically take away the ball that has the arthritis on it. and we put an artificial ball that's attached to a stem that goes inside the thigh bone, and then we shave away the arthritis in the socket, and we, you know, cap that with a metal socket with a piece of plastic on the inside of it. So the new hip is actually most oftentimes a ceramic ball moving inside of a plastic shell.
But aren't there also like tendons and things attached to it?
Yeah, so
you have to reattach that.
The tendons and the muscles all alone. So no matter what approach we do to get inside the hip, we just split the muscle on the way, but we don't really detach any tendons or muscles or anything. We just kind of split it and we just sew it up on our way out.
Well, that answers my question is, how do you do that? So you don't do that. I was like, how do you detach and attach a tendon like that?
No, we don't really detach tendons or like that anymore, especially with the way surgical techniques have really evolved over the past 10 years. We've gotten really, really good at minimizing the soft tissue, the trauma or, you know, that's required in these operations.
So I come in for a hip replacement as it's a successful surgery. What is the healing time or what's the range, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's, you know, patients, you know, I'll rephrase that a little bit. What patients end up asking is, well, what's my downtime? And I usually rebuttal that question with another question. And I say, well, downtime to do what exactly, right? So everyone's expectations are a little bit different. So healing, you know, full healing from a hip or knee replacement takes about a year. But the bulk of the improvements happen in the first 6 to 8 weeks. But there's no real downtime. It's not like you're laying in bed for a couple of weeks and then you're progressively walking. You're walking right away. I mean, a lot of these surgeries are done. Majority of them are done on an outpatient basis. And sometimes if you're, you know, healthy enough at a standalone surgery center, you're walking right away. You're doing stairs right away. There's no real restrictions in that regard. But just recoup from surgery itself is the recovery part. And the bulk of that happens in the first 6 to 8 weeks.
6 to 8 weeks. Okay. So you can walk, but you're in pain, I would imagine. And
yeah, it's just more surgical pain. It's not the arthritic pain. I mean, people that have hip replacements or knee replacements, they're in agonizing pain for months to years and years and years. And then all of a sudden, instantly it goes away. And then all the pain is a different type of pain. It's more surgical pain that gets better. I mean, it's more light at the end of the tunnel as opposed to just debilitating pain that's just worsening and worsening.
Okay. So do you know, as we said, you specialize in hip and knee. Does a doctor in orthopedics need to specialize? I mean, are there doctors out there? Maybe they specialize in one type, but maybe they can treat someone with another or someone who does it all. Is that even?
Yeah, absolutely. So the short answer is a lot, you know, in orthopedic surgery training, we get trained on everything. So I got trained in hand and spine and oncology and shoulder, elbow, foot and ankle, and every subspecialty we get trained on. But it's pretty much, you know, the more subspecialty training you have, the better you are. So, you know, if you're doing, you know, about 500 of the same types of procedures, what you're going to develop skill set wise is a lot different as opposed to if you're doing 20 a year. So the way, you know, medicine and surgical, you know, subspecialists are evolving, it's a very, very, you know, unique niche that's being developed. So I do hips and knees and revision hips and knees, and that's all I do. You know, my partners, you know, they have hand, they have spine. So as a consumer, as a patient, most patients want to go to a surgeon that does a lot of the same thing over and over again to have the more reproducible outcomes, so to speak. So I think in the modern medicine era that we're living in, I think subspecialists are pretty much the norm. You know, back 30 years ago when we didn't have these additional subspecialty training programs, then you had the general orthopedic doctor that was doing it all. But now as things have evolved over time, I think it's hard to, you know, it's hard to really, it's hard for patients to go to a surgeon that doesn't do a lot of them because you have other surgeons that do a lot of the same subspecialty type of procedures.
So at this point in your career, if it's not hip and knee, you're going to refer them to one of your associates?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Correct. I look at it like, you know, what would I want from my own mom, dad, grandma, grandfather, right? So, you know, do I want a, you know, if they broke their wrist, you know, God forbid, do I want a spine surgeon or a hip and knee replacement surgeon fixing my mom's wrist? Even though he's probably qualified to do it, you know, but, you know, knowing what I know, or would I want a hand surgeon who that's all he does, fixing my mom's wrist? And it's, you know, 10 out of 10 times, if you pose it that way, the answer is always, I want the subspecialist. I want the nothing but the best for my family member, right? So
right.
If I want nothing but the best for my own mother, then, you know, I look at that the same way as to treating any other patient, because that's somebody else's, you know, mother, father, you know, family member. So. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're talking about your mother. Let's talk about my mother. My mother had knee replacement surgery a couple years ago, and it went well. Everything's good. But it took her quite a while to finally agree to have the procedure. What do you say to elderly patients, or any patients for that matter, who are hesitant about getting it done when you know they need it?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's always that's the art of medicine, you know, the things that you don't learn in the textbooks, the things you kind of learn from experience.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times when I talk to patients, a lot of it is just not knowing what to expect, or it's, you know, bad experiences that they heard from their friends or other family members, and how detrimental their you know, recovery may or may not have been. So a lot of times when interestingly enough, you know, this just happened a few weeks ago, where a patient had a knee replacement surgery about 25 years ago. And the way we were doing things 25 years ago is head and shoulders different the way we're doing things now. I mean, she was in the hospital for 3 weeks, was in a rehab center for another three to six weeks. And it was just a really, really long recovery. And I basically told that patient, like, we don't really do that. You're going to have a different experience. So when I told her what the experience on average is like now in 2021, mm-hmm. I mean, it was just the education part of it was all the difference maker. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I basically tell them realistic expectations, how we manage pain, how it's a lot better now, and basically tell them, listen, this is a quality of life procedure. You can continue to just be in debilitating pain, and as arthritis worsens with time, they'll be in more and more pain. Or we can do something about it, and yes, it is a grueling recovery initially, but in the short to intermediate term or the long term, they'll be a lot better off. They'll be, you know, getting back to some of the activities that they want to get back to doing and living a happier life.
Now, would you consider the replacement? Was that considered a routine surgery at this point?
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, a hip and knee replacement is considered routine.
What are some, do you get into anything that's a little more difficult?
Yeah, so sometimes you have these complex primary cases where there's a really bad deformity, and a lot of times that bad deformity happens from, you know, a childhood injury or fractures around the knee or the hip that were not fixed. And, you know, so every now and then you get these complex deformity cases, which is a little bit more involved than just a routine hip or knee. But on average, the, you know, arthritic conditions of the hip or knee are pretty routine, that are amenable to first-time hip and knee replacement types of procedures.
Okay, so if I come to you, and are there some procedures or some, I guess, ailments, you'd call them, where maybe surgery isn't needed? Like, how do you determine if surgery is needed? What's the line? And is it as simple as, say, an MRI?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So a lot of the diagnosis for arthritis happens based on plain x-rays, and I shoot different types of x-rays to get different angles of the hip or knee that may be needed to help determine that. And then a lot of it is just, you know, based on the symptoms and based on the clinical presentation. So if patients, you know, their story, if they're having worsening pain along the joint line, if it's not getting any better, you know, they've done the activities of, you know, modifying some of their activities, or they're losing the weight, and they've done the therapy, you know, medicines over the counter as well as prescription types of anti-inflammatories, you know, plus or minus injections. Mm-hmm. You know, the injections for the knees are a little bit different than doing injections in the hip, but they've done that. You know, if they've exhausted all conservative options and they're still having worsening pain and it's not managed and it's really affecting their quality of life and activities of daily living, then surgery makes some sense. So, you know, sometimes an MRI is needed if the x-rays are not clear enough, especially on the hip side of things more than the knee. Mm-hmm. But we don't always need an MRI to make that determination.
Has it ever been where you knew right away, as soon as, you
yeah.
know, they're just describing yeah, yeah. the pain and you could, you know, immediately?
Absolutely. So between the x-rays and the symptoms that patients have, then, you know, I pretty much have an idea. But at the end of it, I kind of tailor it towards, you know, it's a collective decision-making process. It's not me saying, hey, you need surgery, you know, let's get the surgery done. It's more of a, you know, agreement, you know, more than just the surgical procedure itself. It's more if patients are mentally ready for it. And there's some patients that have, you know, the worst x-rays that I've seen in a long time, and their pain is managed with some medicines and with some periodic injections. And I kind of go through all the options on a routine basis, and they're not willing to have surgery, you know, at this moment in time, and that's okay. And we continue to follow them and educate them. And the moment that they're mentally ready for it is when we do it, because half the battle and the recovery and everything, it's all, you know, they have to come around to it. They have to be accepting of it. And a lot of it is mental. You know, if they're mentally not accepting it and not ready for it, they'll have a bad outcome, because any little thing, any little other pain that they'll still feel afterwards, mm-hmm. you know, they're going to instantly regret it and wish they never had it done. So a lot of it is managing expectations and really guiding patients along that way. So until they're mentally ready to have a procedure like that done.
And what do you recommend for the people, recommend that they don't do in order to preserve their knees, you know, their hips? Or, like, for instance, I run a lot. I run like every day, and a few months back I had something going on in my ankle, and I gave it a little rest, and it went away after about a week, and then I'm back up again, and I'm doing fine. Is there too much? Let's stick with running. Is there too much running you can do? Will it hurt your knees, your ankles, what have you? And is there a certain like surface that you shouldn't run on a lot?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in general, heavy pounding activities wear out your hips and knees a little bit quicker. Mm-hmm. So running itself is not a problem, but if you're running on uneven ground, or you're doing a lot of jumping, or off, you know, it's off the road type of running, and it's and you're really, you know, having pounding activities, that wears it out a little bit quicker. In general, squats, if you're you know, big into working out, squats are pretty bad for your hips and your knees.
Okay.
So I generally recommend not to do that. You know, but at the same time, you don't want to limit a patient so much where they're not able to enjoy some of the things that they enjoy in life. So, you know, my job is just to tell them the things that can wear out their hips and knees a little bit quicker. And then they just, you know, patients typically decide if they can modify some of those activities or if they can.
So someone who runs, say, 3 to 4 miles a day on flat ground, whether it be blacktop or cement, no concern there?
Not really. No.
Okay.
I actually encourage that, because I want patients to stay active. So running, you know, on flat ground, you know, that's no issues at all.
Okay. What are the most common conditions that people come in when they come and see you? And maybe they do need replacement, maybe they don't. But what's the most common thing that you see?
Yeah. So it's all different types of arthritis that I see. You know, most patients, you know, that end up seeing me, they get to me after, you know, they've done all the conservative options already. So I don't really see the 20-year-old, you know, kid with knee pain. Mm-hmm. By the time they come see me, they've exhausted all the conservative options and they're ready for surgery. So I have this subspecialty type of practice already. So a lot of the patients have been vetted out already, in terms of they've gone to the other doctors and have kind of worked them up. And by the time they see me, they're mentally there. They want to have the surgery done. And occasionally there's patients that come see me that are not there yet, and I still guide them along and, you know, from a conservative option.
Okay, so let's say someone, they get to you, they go through it, and you determine that knee or hip replacement is needed and recommended, and they agree that, okay, let's do this. What are the next steps? How long does it take, and how long before they're, before the surgery? Because we talked about the recuperation process earlier.
Absolutely. So, you know, it depends on, you know, generally speaking, it depends on the surgeon in terms of how far they're booking out surgery-wise. But typically what's needed beforehand is they have to see their primary internal medicine doctor or their general practitioner. They have to see a heart doctor. Depending on if they've seen a dentist within the past 1 year or not, I usually have my patients see a dentist if it's been more than a year since they've seen a dentist. And depending on where I'm doing the surgery, if they're a good candidate, if I do it robotically or I use any other technology, sometimes they may need an additional CAT scan for some of these technologies that are available to me. So typically that takes, you know, getting everything like that squared away, takes about 4 to 6 weeks at the earliest.
4 to 6 weeks. Now, you also specialize in Mako Smart Robotics. What exactly is that?
Yeah, great question. So I do a decent amount of robotic surgery. I was one of the, doctors that helped spearhead building a robotic total joint replacement program at JFK in Central Jersey. So the Mako is one vendor-specific robotic technology platform for hip and knee replacement. I was trained on it, so I use that because it's one of the older robots with the longer research and data behind it. That's why I use that. For that, you need a CAT scan ahead of time to help preoperative plan the surgery before you actually go ahead and do the surgery. And, what I tell patients about robotic joint replacements, especially if they're a candidate for it, is that it makes things more accurate. So no matter, the best surgeons or the humans in the world that can identify things to the nth degree, we're still humans, there's mm-hmm. still an element of human error. If there wasn't, then we would be machines, basically. So the robot basically helps you execute the plan that you want to execute 100% of the time without any deviations to that plan. It is a technology that I have available to me, and if I'm able to use it, I certainly like using it.
Well, it's fascinating, but you don't just push a button and leave the room, right?
So it's not like that at all.
It's
so
each step.
It's robotic assistance. So, you make all your adjustments on a computer screen ahead of time, and when you're actually making the bony cuts or you're preparing the socket for hip replacement, you're using the robot has an arm, basically, and you're basically using that arm for assistance, because that arm doesn't let you deviate outside of the plan. So it gets locked into the position where you want it. So if you want to have it at half a degree or a quarter of a degree or half a millimeter or a quarter of a millimeter, that's how precise it can dial it in, and it doesn't let you deviate. So there's no tremors in the robot. There's no deviating
right.
in or out or up or down. It's that precise. So you're basically using that arm, and you're guiding that arm to execute whatever you need to execute.
No shaking as like a human may.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No shaking at all.
So you mentioned JFK. I know you're associated with JFK Medical Center, Jersey Shore University Medical Center, Raritan Bay Medical Center, but you also founded thejointteam.com.
Yeah, so that's my own personal brand of team is the Joint Team. So that includes my medical assistant, my surgical scheduler, and ultimately I'm getting a physician assistant. So our brand is basically providing the utmost, highest level of patient care and joint replacement to the communities that I serve. So I'm part of, a private practice orthopedic institute of Central Jersey, but my own brand within that is the Joint Team.
Great. Before we let you go, what are some of the latest advances? What's the biggest advance to you that is, obviously that's happened recently?
I think the biggest advancement that's been brewing over the past 10 years is robotic technology. But
okay.
It's not just the robotic technology itself. It's the whole package that comes with it. So these technologies, are very, very good. But if it doesn't really integrate patient care or patient outcomes, then it's kind of futile, right? It's kind of a moot point. So
mm-hmm.
the way technology has really advanced, and the whole package deal that comes with it, we're now able to track patients before surgery, the surgical time period with the robotics and all the data points that are collected, and tracking these patients how they're doing after surgery. So, patient A, how they were beforehand, throughout the surgical time period, I did this in the OR, I made these changes, and it would help execute it to this end result. How does this end result affect the patient's in the 30 days, 90 days, up to a year?
Mm-hmm.
So now with all this information that we have, we can accurately track patients to see exactly how they're doing and to see if we make other adjustments, if that affects how patients will do in terms of their pain or the outcomes or their function or anything else like that. So the way we really, really incorporate technology in this day and age, it's very, very exciting. And I think it bodes very, very well for the future.
Well, Doctor, I appreciate you taking the time. Dr. Ahmed Siddiqui, Hackensack Meridian Health, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me, Joe. Appreciate it.
This has been JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Keep getting better. Until next time, I'm Joel Katz.